bringing Gosport closer to you.
The Community Show with
Paul Dodd on Gosport Hospital Radio.
Well, that didn't quite go as we meant to start it, but we'll carry on with it. How deep is your love? Why not? Take that version. Sophie just turned 9 when she was diagnosed with cancer. Sophie is the middle of 3 daughters, Gareth and Charlotte Fair, all of the parents. Lucy is 5 years older than Sophie, and Amelia is 51 weeks younger than Sophie. Today, I am indeed honoured and very privileged to interview one of the bravest people I've ever met, and over the next hour or so, I hope to show you why I think that and what you can do to help. I'm going to be saying welcome to Charlotte Fairhall. Take That. Right, so first things I've got to say is, Charlotte, welcome to Gosport Hospital Radio.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're more than welcome, trust me. So, she started bleeding while on holiday with a nanny and grandad. And I realise that's a little bit traumatic, certainly as a 9-year-old, especially how ignored you were by the NHS. Tell us.
Yeah, so Sophie had had stomach pains and was feeling sick for quite a few months in the lead up to that. So maybe end of June, trying to sort of pinpoint when she started sort of first pain, but definitely towards the end of June, July. And you sort of put it off to other things to start with as parents. You think, you know, tummy pains, it could be lots of other things. So, but then it became much more persistent. Certainly in the August, it was like near enough every day, and I was like, something's not right here. This is really unusual. So we tried to get hold of the doctor, but obviously this was COVID times, so trying to actually see a doctor was a challenge. But they initially gave us some Gaviscon, which I was initially going, that's definitely not. I didn't even give it to her. I knew 100% that that was not the right thing. Heartburn. I was like, I'm talking about her stomach, not anything else. So, and then there was a week in August that she couldn't move. She was literally in bed, unable to move, the pain and just feeling so sick. So I phoned the doctors and said, look, you need to see her. Something is not right. She is not, you know, she's a nine at that point, a nine-year-old child, literally bedbound for a few days. So they did see her and felt her tummy and felt a bit hard, but thought probably it's a bowel infection, which hopefully get better on its own, and said to come back if it doesn't, which she then started to slightly pick up a bit. So you think, okay, they must be right. But then she literally then went on holiday with her nan and granddad. And say on the second day of that, she started bleeding, but didn't know what it was too embarrassed to say to anyone, because obviously we weren't there. And it was only when she came back from that holiday when I noticed and said, what's happening? She said, I don't know, but I'm still bleeding, mum. So this was around 8 days of bleeding. So I phoned the GP straight away and I said, look, something is wrong now. I know something is seriously wrong. And they said, it'll be her first period. And I said, I can tell you hands down, this is not her first period. 100% is not. I said, she's just turned nine. And they said, what's possible? And I said, it might be possible. Well, one, you haven't seen her to rule that out. And I said, and two, that you don't, you know, why is she still bleeding when we are now 8 days on? I know how a period works. This is not how it works. And particularly for her first period at her age. So they said, well, we'll call you back on Monday, because this was a Friday. We'll call you back on Monday and then we'll see her if she's still bleeding. But then on Saturday morning, I woke up and I just thought, I just had this niggle. I can only call it like a mother's instinct, just going, you've got to act on this, Charlotte, because something is seriously wrong. And I phoned 111 and I just said the same, something's not right. I know it's not right. And they, obviously after a number of hours going back and forward with 111, they then said, well, the only thing we can offer is to go and see an out-of-hours GP and give her an injection to stop her bleeding. And I said, why would you do that to a nine-year-old child when you don't know the cause of why she's bleeding? And they said, well, if you're that concerned, take her up to A&E. And that's exactly what I did. So I went up on the Saturday, the 5th of September, 2020, and we went straight through. She was quite, you know, she was moaning and having to come off of roadblocks to go up there, and looked, you know, well in herself, you know, sat around the playroom in the waiting area, running in. And then they said how long she had this lump for, and I went, what lump? And they found a 12 centimeter tumor in her abdomen.
Wow.
And that was the day then that I knew then, thought, we're on a, this is not going to be good. And this is,
I've got to ask the question.
Yeah.
Could anything have been done if they'd have found it earlier?
It's always that what if, because I think as a parent, you go through, this goes through my mind a lot. It's hard because if it had been picked up a bit earlier, then obviously it wouldn't have spread so far in her abdomen and impacted on so many areas that have did cause a lot of problems. And obviously it meant that the surgery, they couldn't remove it all, which obviously had issues in itself. We know with cancer, the sooner you pick up cancer, the better the outcomes are.
Absolutely.
So it was stage three for her. So we know if it was an earlier stage, we might have been different. We'll never know.
No.
I just know it was in a very aggressive type. So
I suppose you hold on to the thought that actually, it's easy to blame the doctor's lack of attention. It's easy to blame. But at the end of the day, even if we had have found it, the chances were because of what it was, rhabdomyosarcoma.
Yeah.
The chances of that ever getting better, no matter what stage we found it at, was minimal.
Yeah, particularly her type, because around 60-ish% of children diagnosed with rhabdo survive. So it is slightly higher, but she had a very aggressive subtype of that. So aggressive. It was like anaplastic cells, so really, really aggressive ones, and they've not really seen anything like that in this country before. They've seen maybe a few others in in Europe, but not many. So she had the most aggressive type of that, which, if you can think, rhabdo is already quite a underfunded cancer for children and hasn't had much change of treatment since the 80s, so you're already up against it, and then you whack on top that she had the most aggressive form of it.
How many cases a year?
So around, for rhabdo, for around 60 to 70 children a year.
So in there's not a lot for them to look at either.
No.
Good grief.
Which is a challenge.
So she had a chemo, 7 weeks of it.
So she had 9 rounds of it over between September and April.
Right.
9 rounds of very aggressive chemotherapy, 4 lots of chemo drugs, which battered her body.
In London?
No, that was all at Southampton.
All right. During COVID?
During COVID, yes.
You on your own?
Yes, only one parent was allowed in at any one time. Which, even when we found out she had cancer, I was told on my own in a room with a doctor. And I asked him, I said, you need to allow my husband to come up and be told. You can't tell him over the phone.
No.
Because they had to get special agreement to get him up.
Hard time, to be fair.
Yeah, definitely.
So then she had the... Did she have the operation before or after?
Yeah, so the operation was the very first thing they did.
Right.
Because they weren't initially sure, even though she had an MRI, she had scans, she had everything, they still weren't sure whether this, what it was. They actually thought initially this could be ovarian. They thought that we had to sign consent to remove her ovaries because they thought it was attached to that, whereas her ovaries remained intact for the rest of her time.
Mm.
So... Yeah, it was only when they opened her up for surgery they realised they had a very different thing in front of them than what they saw on scans, which you think, in our day and age, we have so much scanning ability. But I know when the surgeon phoned us, we had a meeting the day before surgery, and he said, it doesn't look benign tumour, but it doesn't look cancerous either. And I said, well, it's one of the two, isn't it? It's some mass in her stomach, and it's got to be one of those two. But he just said, this doesn't look normal. And only then I said to my husband, this is going to be a rare type.
Yeah.
And I said, I know this is going to be something they've probably not seen before. And it ended up being pretty much something that was really rare and aggressive.
And is it at that point you start getting prepared?
No, because I think she responded quite well to the treatment. So obviously the surgery, they managed to remove 95% of the tumour, which is good.
Yeah.
You know, really good. And... they then, you know, the chemo she responded to, so it started to erode the rest of her, the cancer that was left. So you start to have hope, thinking, okay, this might work now. And we just thought, we've got to get through each round, round and round. And obviously we then had radiotherapy in the mix. So we started the cancer treatment after her surgery in the September. So very extensive surgery this was. I mean, she was in there for about 7 hours operation.
Wow.
It was, you know, her scar went from one end of her tummy to the other. And they had quite a number of surgeons working on her with that. And then she had a few complications after that, but then she went near enough straight into chemo. So a poor body.
Okay.
And then, so that was in September. And then it was in the December, we went up to London, UCLH Hospital, for radiotherapy.
Okay.
Which was for 7 weeks.
That's not good.
And that was the second lockdown.
Wow.
Which, I don't know if everyone remembers, obviously that was when everyone was in either tier 4, tier 2, everyone was, what we were doing for Christmas, where we're going to be. And then we went into a full lockdown again, didn't we? But, yeah, we were in London for that whole time. So we went up on the, I think it was the 21st of December and came back in February.
Christmas.
So we came back Christmas... very late Christmas Eve. We weren't sure if we were going to make it, and then we had to go back after Boxing Day.
So
back up. So,
but predominantly in the hospital on your own.
Yeah.
No help.
No.
How on earth did you cope?
I've wondered that myself, to be honest. I think if anyone was telling me this story, I'd say, "How did you cope?" Because I don't know if I would. But when you have a child in front of you who's going through the treatment, you have no other choice but to cope because they need you more than anything. If we crumble, they've got no one left to get through and have the ability to fight. So you put on that front, lots of crying in the showers. obviously we often had obviously our own room with an ensuite because obviously she had no infection ability to fight an infection, so we always had our own room. So yeah, a lot of shower crying because I didn't want to hear her to hear me crying. And I wrote a lot, so I wrote a daily blog.
Right.
And that was like my therapy. It was my release of having to write what on earth had happened that day. And we had some really horrendous traumatic days. Witnessing your child or me having to be involved in pinning her down to get some things, procedures done to her against her will, or even down to the COVID test, which she hated, we had to pin her down for. Or witnessing the horrific impact that the chemo had on her, which was awful, witnessing that for anyone, but particularly your child. So, and there were days you think, oh, I don't know how I'm going to keep processing the amount on top, because there was no let up.
No.
It was one thing after another after another. But I just thought, we just got to keep getting through. We've got to keep getting through. And Sophie came up with the saying during quite early on of saying, we've got to see the good in every day. No matter how bad our day is, Mum, we've got to see the good in every day. There's always going to be something that we can see the good in. I don't know how she had that attitude, to be honest. But she somehow found some strength from somewhere.
I have a 9-year-old grandson that lives at our house at the moment. And I have to say, I don't know where they get it from, but they are so mature. Parents could learn a lot from their own children.
Definitely.
Let's play your first record. Coldplay, Yellow.
Yes.
Why?
So we love Coldplay, lots of their songs, but Yellow particularly. Sophie's favourite colour was yellow in the end. She changed during her treatment from pink to yellow, and it was obviously yellow, and a lot of the words in the song really resonate with us, obviously following Sophie's death. So yeah, it's a really important song, and it was played at her funeral.
Coldplay, Yellow.
Yeah. I bleed myself dry.
Hello by Coldplay. So, for those of you who just joined, I'm here today with Charlotte Fairhall, who is the CEO, more importantly, the mother to Sophie, who is the theme of Sophie's legacy. So, she's had the operation, she's had the tumour, you were in London, she relapses. What happens then?
Yeah, so we finished the treatment, the frontline treatment, with all of our chemo and radiotherapy in the end of April. And we started on maintenance chemotherapy, which was me giving her chemo at home every day and going into hospital once a week. But it's a day patient to give her chemo. And this was meant to happen for a year. But we got 8 weeks into that and she relapsed. So this was during a routine MRI, got picked up that a new tumour had been formed right in the area that had the most extensive treatment you could have given. How it got through that radiotherapy is beyond anyone. She had literally the lifetime max of radiotherapy. They couldn't have given her highest dose if you tried, in specifically in this massive area, in which she had the radiotherapy to whole abdomen, but they really homed in on this around the bladder area, which they think is where it originated, and say how it got through that those cells. It really showed everyone that we were up against it now.
Yeah.
We knew then we were probably not going to make this. They said that anything now was talking about giving her time, biding us time, really. They're never getting a cure. That chance of cure had gone, really, at that point. They came up with a few options and they sort of talked about, well, the trouble is her relapse, one of the relapse options of chemo treatment that we could have had, she couldn't because of the issues she was having from her bowel, which had happened right from surgery onwards. She'd never recovered, her bowel never recovered from the very start. And the chemo treatment, the relapse one, had a huge impact on the bowel. So
right.
They said, we can't give her this. It would kill her, just giving it to her, to be honest.
Wow.
So we were left with very little option. And there's not been enough treatment research onto this. That's part of the problem. So we then tried, say, one chemo, which was me giving her chemo at home. I sort of knew this was never going to work. I thought, she needs really aggressive chemo if this is ever going to go. But it was just going to come straight back. So we made the decision with the doctors and with Sophie, because she knew I wanted to tell her all the way through what was going on. She was a very bright 9-year-old who knew exactly what was happening, and she said, I don't want any more, Mum. I've had enough. I want to be out of hospital. I don't want to be in there. I want to create memories. I want to do everything with my sisters, my mum and dad, and live whatever life I've got left. And somehow she came up,
That's a real brave and grown-up response, isn't it?
Really did. When I told her, the cancer was back and it looks unlikely we might ever get it, she did cry, which, I'll tell you, hardest thing I've probably ever had to tell anyone, really.
Yeah.
And but then from that day on, she just didn't moan. She just got on with it. She just literally packed in as much as she could into every day. She used to wake up in horrific pain, throughout the rest of her time she had left, and she said, give me everything you have got,
Mum. She had nothing left to lose, has she, really?
No, she said, give me everything you've got, Mum. I need every drug you can get because I need to get through this. And she somehow powered through and achieved... she wrote a bucket list and achieved what she wanted, apart from...
So what were some of those things on the bucket list?
So she wanted to meet Gordon Ramsay and cook with him, which she got to do.
Okay.
She loved that.
Was life not painful enough?
Oh, she was so funny with him as well, doing selfies with him and everything. He was so, so good with her.
As aggressive as he is on television, he is probably one of the nicest, kindest guys you could ever wish to meet.
He is. He's a dad of five.
Yeah.
He gets this, and he was so kind, and he's still in contact now, you know, 2 years on, so he's such a lovely, lovely man. He's not what you see on TV.
No.
It's a good front, that is.
Absolutely.
She wanted to own a pair of high heels.
Right.
Which she got to do. She wanted to be an adult for the day, which is what I said to her when she wrote that.
What does that mean, then? What does it mean?
And she said, you go to work, you cook, you clean, and you drive. I thought, that probably sums
up my day.
So she worked at Tesco's Burgledon and worked there for the day and absolutely loved it. She wanted to go around on an ice cream van and give us all the biggest ice creams that she could have found to her friends, which they thought this was the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Four flakes out of this ice cream and the biggest ice cream I've ever seen.
Good girl.
But it was all things like, really, that you would expect from a nine-year-old in that sense. But there were some things on there that made it very different bucket list. Mm. And they were things that she asked us to do when she'd gone.
Right.
And that's what made her list really quite different. How on earth she had the thought to think, actually, I want this, you to achieve this, Mum, when I've gone.
It's amazing.
I still can't get my head around that, to be told she knew she was dying and then to still think of others.
And hasn't she? So her first record, Olivia Rodrigo.
Yes.
Why was this so special?
She just loved Olivia Rodrigo, and you know, she would sit there. We have lots of memories of her at home, obviously recovering from a treatment or whatever, and she would always say, Alexa, play Olivia Rodrigo. And yeah, she just absolutely loved her.
I have to say, she did get to meet her. Right. Oh,
virtually.
Really? Okay.
But that was our hardest one off her bucket list, actually.
So we've got the official video for this one.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, early warning, it's not the cleanest song you've ever heard. And that's all I'm going to say. Apologies in advance.
I got my driver's license last week, just like we always talked about. Cause you were so excited for me to finally drive up to your house. But today I drove through the suburbs crying cause you weren't around. And you're probably with that blonde girl who always made me doubt. She's so much older than me, she's everything I'm insecure about. Yet today I drove through the suburbs, cause how could I ever love someone else? And I know we weren't perfect, but I've never felt this way for no one. And I just can't imagine how you could be so. Said forever, now I drive alone past your street. And all my friends are tired of hearing how much I miss you, but I kind of feel sorry for them, cause they'll never know you the way that I do. Yet today I drove through the suburbs and pictured I was driving. Yeah. street. Red lights, stop signs, I still see your face in the white cars, front lines, can't drive past the places we used to go to, cause I still fucking love you, babe.
So, Olivia Rodrigo, Driving License. Lovely song.
Yeah.
Absolutely lovely. So, bucket list done. The fact that the pain and the discomfort she was in while she was doing those as well is amazing. July 21 when she stopped treatment?
Yeah.
So, she wanted things changed. What things? And why?
So she wanted parents to be fed in hospital when they stay overnight. She couldn't ever understand why I was never fed when staying in. And because we were in COVID times, in order for me to go and get food, I had to leave her. And she kept saying, please don't leave me, Mum. So I knew that if she was ever going to come up with anything, this would be very high on her list. So, yeah, she wanted parents to be fed. She wanted improvements to children's food in hospital. No surprise there, probably, because that probably goes for adults as well. But she said the food was disgusting, was her words.
Now, this rang a bell with me, because both of my grandchildren have been in hospital. So I rang my daughter-in-law and said, didn't you get something from Sophie's Legacy? And she said that when the grandson, Isaac, who's only two now, was taken for breathing issues at QA, Children's Emergency Department. She completely forgot to pack any food-related things other than nappies and wipes for him. And the food box was amazing. Mm. She had been with him when he was 2 months old previous to that visit, so we're only talking 18 months ago. And that was before Sophie's snack box was there. He was kept for hours for bloods and observations, and she had had nothing to eat or drink. So it was a massive support for her and for other parents just having it there, because it helped keep her going.
Yeah.
Because she found it so difficult to cope with her son the first time round with having no sustenance at all. But having had that little bit of sustenance just gave her that kick to go on.
Yeah,
so that was down to you. Thank you.
That's good. Sadly, lots of children do get admitted to hospital, and you know, particularly the winter. And actually, your only choice to get food is to go to Costa, the very expensive shop, or the restaurant, which is miles away.
Or the vending machine.
Or the vending machine, which is not actually that many in
the
hospital these days. So, but you've got to, you know, it's really expensive, and you know, you can't leave your children that long.
No.
You're either waiting for the doctors to come around, or they're that unwell that you can't leave them.
Yeah.
So it creates such an issue for parents. I cannot understand why they are not fed. And this, I always thought, oh, maybe they had cutbacks, and that's why they thought, oh, we won't feed parents, you know, with money and everything else in the NHS. But I've since learned that actually, since parents were allowed to stay in with their children back in the 60s, I think it was, they have never been fed. This has never been a thing that has ever come up to even have a discussion around why parents not fed, which is just crazy in that sense. Do you think like that? The only thing in the parents' room that you got is a kettle or a microwave. And there is nothing to even put in that kettle or microwave to be able to even get yourself some food. So you have to have had the foresight to have actually brought some food in with you, which I tell you, no parent actually does.
Well, invariably it's a 999 ambulance, you know, and you're waiting for the ambulance, and you get in the ambulance with the patients, and you forget all about anything else.
You
know, the number of times that I've been in with my children, you don't even remember money to come home with.
Yeah.
You know, they let you out of the hospital, and you think, how the heck am I not going to go home?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, going back 20 years, there were no things such as mobile phones. You know, so who do I call? How do I get home? Taxis weren't as prevalent as they are today. And it really was, can you lend me 20p to get on the bus, please?
Yeah.
Yeah, with my little boy, he's still in his pyjamas.
Yeah. But so if you really wanted there to be better support for parents, so that they don't have to worry so much around how are they going to get some food, how are they going to get some toiletries. I had that a number of times when I went in, always forgot something. Or how am I going to, you know, get some clothes, or how am I going to get home? Because those were things that actually we can be covering, and we do cover as a charity.
Yeah.
We want parents to be focusing on their child that's ill, not worrying about all the other factors that's distracting them from, you know, having to phone around everyone and trying to get things up. Because sadly, there's a lot of families in there that don't have that support.
And the play specialist?
Yeah, so she wanted play, to be allowed to have a play specialist or access to play 7 days a week, not just Monday to Friday, which is currently is in quite a lot of hospitals. So, yeah, she wanted there to be 7 days a week to actually help reduce some of the trauma that she went through. So they do a lot of, you know, help with going through procedures and things like that. And actually, that doesn't stop. Procedures don't stop on a weekend.
Absolutely.
These children still have to go through a lot, but what happens is that they don't have anyone around who has got the child's sort of a play ability to be able to help that. It's the nurses and doctors that are left to try and do that.
And people should know about things like that, because if you're in hospital for a broken leg, physiotherapists don't come to you on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Yeah.
So actually, if they're not coming to an adult on a Saturday and Sunday, what chance have you got of going to a child on a Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh, good grief, yeah.
So she wanted them, and she also wanted there to be improvements to the amount of money spent on children's cancer.
Now, I didn't know this until I read her legacy. 3%.
Yeah.
And the rate of children to adults is...
So the percentage, it's always a hard one, because there is more adults that get diagnosed with cancer than children.
Yeah, I get that.
Because actually a fair few of adults get it because of lifestyle and environment, and we've lived a lot longer, or age, or, you know, I know my granddad got cancer in his 80s, and, you know, the longer we live, the more chance we have of getting cancer.
Absolutely.
So, but that figure of, you know, they put everyone who's had cancer from zero right to someone in their hundreds, and then they work on what percentage of that is 0 to 18s, and that's 1%. But I don't think that's a really fair way of trying to work on how many, because actually that's only 18 years.
But if they was to put more funding towards the children, perhaps some of the adults might not get it so much.
I think it actually would actually even find kinder treatments.
We call it a self-licking lollipop, don't we?
Yeah. I think if you invested more, then you would definitely, I think, be able to find kinder treatments that adults could have.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, these children, Sophie had the same treatment that you or I would have had if we'd been diagnosed with exactly the same cancer. It's crazy to think.
And cruel.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy to think she was given treatment that's designed for adults, but given to children. Because actually, we know that these children have still got to grow. They haven't finished their development.
If sports can have teams by age, why can't the hospitals have treatment by age?
Yeah.
You know.
It's because sadly there's no drugs. In the last 20 years, only 4 drugs have been designed for children. The last 20 years.
And where are you with the legacies at the moment?
So we are obviously doing lots. We're in 9, soon to be 10 hospitals, and we support families by making sure they have access to food, to toiletries, to clothes. We help with funding transport to and from the hospital, do birthday parties in hospital, We have Costa vouchers, anything that they need that's going to reduce some of this pressures on these parents, really. We offer a lot of emotional support. We have an art therapist that goes into the hospital at Portsmouth. That's one day a week, and we're about to start working in the community with that because Sophie loved her art. And actually, a lot of these children have long-term stays. They go in and out, they bounce in and out long periods of time, and we want to reduce some of this trauma for them. So, obviously on the food side, we're doing that. We've also done a lot of national work because I stupidly asked Sophie before she died, do you want me to just sort out Portsmouth and Southampton Hospital? And she said, no, you need to do the whole country, Mum. And I did think then, I thought, what? Why did I ask her that? I could have just assumed she wanted me to sort out Portsmouth and Southampton. So we have been doing a national project. We're working with the very top of the NHS.
Okay.
And we went into the 9 big children's hospitals as the Sophie's Legacy trial and fed every parent that was in there. And that's places like Alderhay, Great Ormond Street, Sheffield, Manchester. And it was an 8 to 12 week trial, and some incredible results.
Yeah.
And feedback that the NHS and us got. And we're now working on what's the next stage. So we now want to go into some, they want to test out the smaller hospitals. So they say smaller, Portsmouth would fall into smaller.
In terms of children's department, it would be.
And they want to see what the costings is going to be and how much, you know, how it's going to be implemented. So we want to test another about 25 hospitals around the country with that, which will be really exciting. And then my ultimate bit is it then rolls out around the country.
Yeah, very much so.
We got a golden nugget of information that actually they're in the NHS, a substantial amount, I couldn't actually believe the figure when I was told, but £250 million a year is wasted on food waste in
You're
the NHS.
You're joking.
£250 million is what the figure is on food waste. Not on food, but on food waste. And actually, we've estimated that to feed every parent in children's, but stays overnight with their child in the UK, well, it's only England to start with, would be 16 million. So you can see this figure, if they are now being targeted, you know, most hospitals have got to reduce their food waste, their bill, that actually we want 16 million ring-fenced to then feed parents.
Yeah.
Because this money was always allocated to food.
Absolutely.
We want it still allocated for food. But to feed parents, and actually we could then change this for the whole sort of the England, which would make a substantial difference.
Wouldn't it
to parents'
just?
Day. I know it would make massive. So we are working on this as a national plan alongside us trying to address the local 10 hospitals in making sure we are feeding the parents that are in there as well. So we're doing a two-prong attack.
Well done,
if
you.
That makes sense.
Right, time is running on.
I could talk forever.
No, it's fine. It really is. Let's talk about your next record. From The Greatest Showman. Why that one? Why that musical? There are a few.
I love The Greatest Showman. I don't know. I think it's just... when I first saw the film, I thought, what a brilliant film this is. It's really empowering and just shows that you can be whoever you want to be and not follow the norm.
That's quite subtle, actually, because this is the record I've chose for you.
Yeah.
This is me.
Stranger to the dark, hide away, they say, 'cause we don't want your broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. Wanna cut me down? I'm gonna send the blood, gonna drown them out. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, 'cause here I come. And I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen. I make no apologies. This is me.
this is me.
Kiala Settle, This Is Me from The Greatest Showman. We've only got 10 minutes left, and I want to get into the ways that other people can help at the moment. But one very, very quick question. How did your husband cope? We haven't spoke about him at all, bless him.
Yeah, he's very quiet, shy. He's a man. He works in IT. He works at home, and he's, quite a private person. Okay. He is... I think men do find it quite difficult to talk at the best of times, let alone something like a, child death. So, but he has found his little outlet of football.
Right.
And escaping for every, couple of months, escaping for a boys' weekend and just getting away from it all, away from the pressures of home and, everything else, and just to be able to talk. And he does talk to his friends. It's just knowing that it's finding someone who actually gets it. And he has met up with some others who have lost their children, and he gets a lot back from that.
Excellent. So it is all about letting him have his space.
Definitely. I think it's important. It goes for anyone, really. I think it builds up at points, and then all of a sudden you think, actually, I just need a bit of time for me. We're not very good as parents always at having that.
No.
And I think, for your own mental health, it is really important.
Sometimes you just have to put that selfish head on and go, I need me now.
Yeah. So that you can be a better parent, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sometimes you just need to reset, go back, kick it off and just go, no, just give me two. And we do it at home. Just give me 2 minutes, leave me alone, come back in 2 minutes' time and I'll give you all the love in the world. But if you carry on dragging me down the way you're going, we'll have nothing.
Yeah.
Anybody who's interested, by the way, just Google Sophie's Legacy. It is a P-H-I-E, Sophie. SophieLegacy.co.uk, I believe. We'll talk about ways to help in a second. Let's do that now. So, we did a fundraising at work a couple of weeks ago, 300 quid. Wonderful. Brought pizzas for a Saturday night for the Charles Ward for Hospital, apparently.
Yeah.
What other ways can people help?
So we have food and toiletry boxes, like of our collection points, dotted all around sort of the south. We have them on our website and our sort of Facebook pages, sort of things of where you can drop them to. You can help raise money for us. We're a charity. We're reliant on money coming in, sadly. This is what we have to keep asking for. We are always needing volunteers. Always needing volunteers, whether that's coming in and putting away donations or helping on a supermarket day or helping with things in the office, admin things, we're always needing them. So anyone who wants to have a regular weekly commitment, or it might be a business who wants to have, corporate days, so they're allowed to have one day a year that they allow their employees to go off and do some volunteering. We were always really grateful for all of those, anything like that, really. We obviously say about sharing the signs and symptoms. We are really trying hard to work on this national campaign with the government on trying to improve the awareness of childhood cancer, and to know that it is not rare. It's not as rare as what people think or made out to believe. One in 450 children by the age of 15 will be diagnosed with cancer. So that's like one in every school. So we, go and look up the signs and symptoms of that. Go and donate blood or platelets if you're able to. So if you went through a lot of bags of blood and platelets, and I gave blood before she was diagnosed, and I certainly give blood since, it literally does save lives. You can just give up a few hours of your life if you're able to still do that, and you'll go and save someone's
life. And anything else you want to look at, people, go onto the website, because they've got the most amazing shop. Not only can you give stuff, buy the sweatshirts, the running vests, t-shirts, hoodies, that sort of things. You can buy food packages. You can buy pizza nights for a ward for the night. It's 120 quid and things like that. But how the heck did you come up with that idea?
Well, we thought having... We were trying to find something that was generic, a bit of food that's generic for everyone, and actually all different, you know, allergies and everything, and pizza was the most easiest for us and for the ward. So we came up with that, and actually we've now expanded out. So, you know, we do Chichester, we do Guildford, we do the Isle of Wight, and they're all, obviously, they're not as expensive. They're a bit cheaper. So, like, Guildford is only, I think, £70.
I've got 1 minute left because I want to get all of this song in because it's your song. I've got one last question. Sophie's got two sisters.
Yeah.
How did they cope? And how does Amelia cope with her birthday being a week later than...
A week before. So, yeah, they have been greatly impacted. It's probably the shortest answer I can give. You know, huge, you know... They were only 9 and 15, I think Lucy was, when Sophie died. So, yeah, pretty pivotal ages, but they still have their struggles.
Yeah.
Lucy described it as the most traumatic thing she's ever gone through, and she'll never be the same again. So, yeah.
You've got a 10K run on October 29th?
Yes.
Where?
So that's at Crofton Community Centre,
right,
in Stubbington, but you can do that anywhere you like.
Okay.
You just buy the medal on our website, and we will either send it out to you if you're not around,
right,
or you can come and collect it on the day, on Saturday 28th of October.
Crofton.
And it's a medal that Sophie designed shortly before she died.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there, if that's all right with you, Charlotte. Yeah. Because I've seen the video to this song, and the video is compiled with the dancers from Alverstoke Dancing Club. This is Joe Downes. Now, Joe Downes wrote this song for Sophie. Joe Downes is an ex-pupil of Crofton School, I believe.
She's an adult. Her child went to
Crofton. Oh, her child went. Oh,
yeah.
It made it sound as though she was an ex-pupil there as well. And this is written for Sophie. Please listen. Beautiful words. The Arc of a Rainbow. Charlotte, thank you.
Thank you.
Flooding out to you. We've taken you in.